Oh, you are, not the other kind. Translation, my dear king, you have said, "You rascal, you dull, crazy fellow, I'm going to chastise you, and then you will come to your senses." In this regard, let me say that although I live like a dull, deaf, and dumb man, I am actually a self-realized person. What will you gain by punishing me? If your calculation is true, and if I am a madman, then your punishment will be like this, that is followed with punishment by a king or by God, who has seen that many thieves are arrested and punished by the police, nonetheless steals again and again. He is obsessed with the idea that by stealing he will be happy. This is a sign of madness. Despite repeated punishment, the thief cannot give up his stealing habit. Therefore, the punishment is useless. This is the last of this section, anyway, of Jed Bharat speaking to the king. I'm going to read the next verse because it's Shukadev Goswami giving a little narrative of what happened and what's about to happen. So text 14, someone can... Well, this section is prose anyway, so next, someone can inform Leela Mundri. Tomorrow's verse is 15. So text 14. Shukadev Goswami said, "O Maharaj Parikshit, when King Rahugana chastised the exalted devotee Jed Bharat with harsh words, that peaceful, saintly person tolerated it all and replied properly. Nescience is due to the bodily conception, and Jed Bharat was not affected by this false conception. Out of his natural humility, he never considered himself a great devotee, and he agreed to suffer the results of his past karma. Like an ordinary man, he thought that by carrying the palanquin, he was destroying the reactions of his past misdeeds. Thinking in this way, he began to carry the palanquin as before." Purport. An exalted devotee of the Lord never thinks that he is a paramahansa or a liberated person. He always remains a humble servant of the Lord. He never accuses the Lord of putting him into a distressed condition. These are signs of an exalted devotee. Tatte nukampam susamikshamanaha. When suffering reversed conditions, the devotee always considers that the reverse conditions are the Lord's concessions. He is never angry with his master. He is always satisfied with the position his master offers. In any case, he continues performing his duty in devotional service. Such a person is guaranteed promotion back home, back to Godhead. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.14.8, then he quotes the Tat tenu kampam si susamik shamano verse with the translation, "My dear Lord, one who constantly waits for your causeless mercy to be bestowed upon him and who goes on suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds, offering you respectful obeisances from the core of his heart, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim." End of purport. So several things, just a little side comment to begin with. The last phrase in text 13 is Pishta Pesha. which Prabhupada has translated as like grinding flour, or like grinding flour. So flour is grain that has already been ground. So if you grind that which has already been ground, what is the gain? So instead of saying that, your punishment will be like grinding flour that has already been powder. He doesn't say that. He said it's like beating a dead horse. It's not in the verse, but it's the same meaning. And the message is there will be no effect. Beat a dead horse. Grinding flour. No gain. So that the metaphor like this, so that yata tata, it's punishing a madman is going to have any effect. Punish a madman. His condition of madness won't change, and it's because he's mad, his behavior won't change. So what's the use of punishing a madman? He's thoroughly checkmated, King Rahugana, or as Shukadeva Goswami is saying, he's spoken properly. He's given transcendental knowledge. He's also given, practical knowledge, the kind like Chanakya Pandit has given, forget the term, teachings on how to effectively rule, as Chanakya Pandit was advising the king, Jad Bhart is advising the king. Don't punish a madman. It'll accomplish nothing. And Prabhupada is taking the opportunity here to express something he commonly expresses, that who is crazy, like the history behind that short essay, who is crazy, is in the beginning of the Hare Krishna movement, the devotees, after some time, began public Harinam and, exhibiting Krishna consciousness that was going on within the storefront, out on the streets and in the parks and here and there. And people would think and say, they're crazy. So, in response, Prabhupada wrote a little essay. Who is crazy? ? And the theme of it was, if you accept your identity to be something that you're not, which is false ego, then, and you act that way, then you're crazy. If somebody goes around saying, I'm Napoleon, and I'm off to the French Revolution, or whatever it was that he was leading, and one thinks that they're Napoleon, whatever the clinical terms are, it would be considered crazy. Misplaced identity. Thinking and acting and behaving and speaking and conducting their life as if they're somebody that they're not. Person's crazy. In common language, whatever the technical term is. So Prabhupada was then saying, anyone who thinks that they're this body and all the designations connected with the body, they're crazy, because that's not who they are. So everyone in material conception of life is crazy. He spoke many times this example of a person committed murder, and the lawyer, this is in India, and a lawyer on his behalf said, well, he did the murder, Your Honor, but when he did it, he was in a crazy state. The man is crazy. has a tendency to be, so he should be excused because he did this in a crazy state. So the judge assigned a professional clinical psychiatrist or whatever to evaluate the person to determine. And when he got on the witness stand, he said, "Your Honor, as far as I'm concerned, all the people that I've interviewed are more or less crazy. So you can decide what you want to do." That's how Prabhupada reported it. So who is crazy? And this, the opening line of the purport is, everyone in this material world is working like a madman under certain impressions falsely acquired in the material condition. Impressions. More commonly, he would say, conceptions, false, they're laboring under false conceptions. But here it's impressions acquired in the material condition. So based upon the senses, we can perceive something. And as we know, multiple persons observing the same thing are going to report their experience differently. Courtrooms are filled with it. People, same thing, different people saying different things about the same thing. Very, very different things. So why is that? They have an impression acquired from the material condition, their senses and the mind and the conceptions they carry within their mind. And it goes on and on. There was something. I forget the exact circumstance, but some experiment was conducted to see, but the experimenters wanted to see if by the power of suggestion people could become convinced that something that never happened happened. So the way it goes is something like this. The experimenters selected their persons. I don't know the process of selection, but like just anybody. And they asked them, did such and such happen? And the reply was, no, such and such didn't happen. And then they went on suggesting that it happened. And they revisited. And the second time, at least out of groups of people, that it shifted to, well, I'm not sure if it happened or not. And then the third time was, it happened. And they were convinced that it happened. The power of suggestion. Although it never happened. And then, you know, privately Prabhupada would speak about propaganda. The Russian propagandists were expert during the communist time of propaganda, making propaganda, and you hear the propaganda long enough and it's reality, although it never happened. It's not like that at all. And, you know, just keep going. You know, history books are written from a certain perspective. In the course of my travels, I met a couple, both PhDs in the field of history, American history. And their specialty of the field of specialization was the history of American Indians. And they said the real story of the history of American Indians isn't at all what you find in the history books. The history books are written by people who are paid to write the history books. And the history book writers are told to, you know, make the American government look good. It smelled good and pretty and, you know, but it was really ugly. Now, the real story is really ugly. And Braja Bihari, some of you know Braja Bihari Prabhu, he now has a full-time job with the Department of Interior. He goes to an office and downtown Washington with the Department of the Interior, and his field, because he's really good at it, is mediation. He has degrees in it, and he's just very gifted in it. So the mediation sector of the Department of Interior is the problems that the American Indians have in their reservations, you know, Indian reservations. But he found out really quickly they have a lot of reservations about Americans. So to have somebody come in that's American and help them deal, sort out their problems, they don't trust them. So he said part of the thing that really helped was, hey, I lived in India for 14 years. And so now he was not American, so they could trust him. And he said, you know, knowing the history, now that I've learned the history, there's lots of reason they have for good reason for not trusting Americans because of the treatment of the American Indians, the native people, what to speak of all the other species of life and, you know, the land and resources and, you know, exploitation to the max. Anyway, perception. Here the word is impressions. Everyone in the material world is working like a madman under certain impressions falsely acquired in the material condition. So that's like a big, broad, whether it's, you know, been suggested to them by some propagandist or however, impressions, because the conceptions of life that you carry determines how you see things, how you feel things, and how you act. It rules your life. So it's very important, as Krishna does in Bhagavad Gita, to right away address the conceptions that Arjuna is carrying before deciding duty. Let's address the conceptions. And if it's a material conception, whatever it is going to be misguided. And so putting in place a spiritual conception. So how do we get conceptions by association is the answer. Like air carries different aromas, so the mind carries different conceptions of life. Doesn't Bhagavad Gita say that? So the air is passing over a garbage dump. You know what from science what air is. It's colorless, odorless, tasteless. And it passes over a garbage dump and it stinks. So the air doesn't stink. Whatever the air is carrying stinks. The odor of garbage stinks. And the air is just carrying it. And then further downwind, it passes over a botanical garden. It doesn't stink anymore. It smells nice. The air is neutral. But the odor may be stinky or fragrant or nice fragrance. And the ocean breeze has its characteristic scent, what it carries, etc. The mind is like that, gathers impressions based upon what we associate with, you know, what the mind is brought to bear upon. And unfortunately, it's Kali Yuga, and things the mind is brought to bear upon creates dark impressions. Like, you know, it wasn't even Kali Yuga yet, and Ajamila as a young man experienced something very unpleasant. And in our modern society, anyway, it's obvious. Crime and violence and raw sex is what sells in the marketplace, movies and media and stuff, and so kids get it. If not just kids, people get it, and then that's impression, and then people act on it because the impression that you carry is going to drive your experiences of life and so on and so on and so on. And then the converse is also there, the spiritual impressions. So madness is there, Prabhupada's like uniform statements. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. The material consciousness, the state of madness is everywhere. And when we go out the door, we should be aware. And there's, you know, there's degrees. There's like criminal-like kinds of madness. And there's, you know, motive goodness kinds of madness. And there's stuff in between. There's all the whole, it's very colorful varieties of madness. But the presumption that we should have is there's madness. He goes on. Oh, so the thief. We find this similar example in what Prabhupada describes. There's qualities of intelligence. One who learns by hearing is the first class intelligent. One who hears but doesn't understand, but then sees, then they understand, second class intelligence. The was it Missouri is the show me state? Yes? Let me see it. Then I can believe it. Okay, now I believe it. But then there are people that hear and they see, and they still don't believe it, or they still don't understand. So then they can experience. And then they understand. And then keep going down, and people that still don't understand. That's what Prabhupada is speaking about. The thief. They know, and they're just driven. Or, you know, cigarette smokers, or people that are addicted to something. But who isn't addicted to material existence? The liberated soul is the only exception. Otherwise, everyone is addicted to something. And give it a nice name, you know, motive goodness thing. So many causes and isms, and people fighting over this ism and that ism. Abortion. One of the discussions I had at IIT with some Chinese students, you know, we had some discussion, and this was 2 years ago. And we got into the discussion about, they asked me, there were like four of them, first time, second time visitors, and asked me, what do I think about abortion? I think, well, do we have the right? So I didn't give a flat answer. I just asked them the question. Do you have the right to take the life of another human being? And they didn't answer the question. They said, well, you know, the government of China supports this because the population is so huge, and it's already out of control. And so to control the population, I think it's a good thing. Okay, well, you know, you're part of the Chinese population. Supposing we can reduce the Chinese population by eliminating you four. Why not? Because the population is huge and some population has to be reduced. What do you think of that? Is that okay? Maybe there's another method of controlling the population. How about sense control to control the population? You know, the discussion didn't go very far after that. How do you accomplish that? By higher taste. And that's what we're presenting here. You come and learn about a higher taste so you don't have to make this decision about taking life because the population is out of control. Madness, driven. And then, you know, in St. Louis, on the way to there's construction on one of the access roads, expressways near the temple, so we have to go this other route. And I think it's Forest Park or something like that. And on the right-hand side, there's an abortion clinic. You know what I'm talking about. So there have been violence outside that abortion clinic. And there's always, at least every time I've been by there, there's people picketing, carrying signs saying, you know, murderer, and don't go inside, we'll have alternatives and stuff like that. We'll help you. And then there's like guards inside because they, you know, the profession is abortion. So the whole thing is madness on both sides. Is it going to be checked by this or that? Like, you know, sometimes abortionists are killed. People, some time ago, somebody was murdered, an abortionist. Somebody just got, they couldn't take it. They let him have it. He got his. At least one time around, and then however many more times around for however many lives he's taken, and etc. So the solution is not, you know, just fighting. And it's the same as what's being said here by Rahugana, by Jed Bharat to Rahugana. And that is, the dullard isn't going to be corrected by punishing the dullard. He'll still be a dullard. So persons that are covered by nescience, where is that? Anyway, covered by nescience. Those that are covered by nescience aren't going to be, their nescience isn't going to be lifted by punishment. Now, it's one way to control behavior, at least as long as, and governments, in some cases, use force to control behaviors. When, you know, if the police are delinquent, then crime increases, and police are very heavy, crime may diminish. You know. But there'll still be crime, and they'll just do, that's, those same people will do their crime in some other way in some other place. They'll find a way, because mode of nature is acting. Then there's his response, which is in the next verse. Jed Bharat, after speaking this way, well, in the previous verse and then in verse 13 and, excuse me, in verse 12 and in 14, he's ready to carry on. Here we go. Nescience is due to bodily conception. There we go. Nescience is due to the bodily conception. Without removing the bodily conception, you're not going to remove nescience. And so you check a behavior, but the bodily conception is there, nescience is there. Activity or behavior born of the bodily conception and nescience is going to come out. So what he's done with the king is address his bodily conception in a number of different ways. He's given transcendental knowledge. Now, having done that, he's prepared to carry on. Like, we need to be prepared to carry on in an atmosphere where nescience prevails, bodily conception prevails. We need not identify with the body that we have and the conception that, according to the designation of the body that we have, although we may behave appropriately according to that position. A man behaves this way, a woman behaves that way, a husband behaves this way, a wife behaves that way, a brahmachari behaves this way, a sannyasi behaves that way, a grihastha behaves that way. We may accept the position of one who has such a designation, but the position of Jed Bharat that we should also understand is suitable for us, is don't identify with it. And then carry on and perform your duty according to that which, in the temporary circumstance, like this example previously of the straws pulled together by the movement of the waves. So for some time, there's this particular configuration of embodiment and juxtaposition of this body with that body, and so we behave accordingly. respectfully, dutifully, for the pleasure of Krishna, knowing that that's not our identity and the waves are going to pull those configurations apart anyway, and pull the body apart anyway, and we'll find some other embodiment as long as we stay in false ego. Giving up the false ego identification, stay in Krishna consciousness, perform activities appropriately for Krishna's pleasure. And then the final part is misfortune. It's not a major part of the verse, but it's how Prabhupada is taking up the message in the purport. Having spoken and disclosed that he is a self-realized soul, that's how Prabhupada has translated it. The Sanskrit of the verse, is sva, it's the last part of the first line. Sva samstam. Samstam. Sva samstam. He's situated, sta, that syllable sta means to be situated. Sva samsta. He's situated in his constitutional position. Although he's being accused of unmata, mata, jada. Jada is dull or dunce, a fool. So jada bharat was how he was known. Jada, dull, dunce, fool. You're accusing me in this way, although sva sangstam, I'm situated in my constitutional position. I understand who I am. I'm Krishna's servant. And I can serve in this capacity, no problem. And now, internally, how does he accept that? Well, there's the positive and the negative. The negative, he doesn't complain and whine and, oh, Krishna, why have you put me in this situation? Look at this horrible thing. This merely mean, dumb king is treating me really cruelly and calling me bad names and threatening me. And, you know, why? This isn't fair. It's unjust. There's no whining and complaining or faulting the master. Rather, as Prabhupada says, he always is satisfied with the position his master offers. Now, there are some things that come about by our decisions, and there's some things that we don't have any decision in it. Like yesterday, somebody wrote to me from some distant place and said, quoting somewhere in the Bhagavatam, where Maya Dhanava, of all people, Maya Dhanava, like, you know, not a good guy, Maya Dhanava, said, what can one do? Circumstances of life by providence were placed in, and it doesn't matter whether you're a demigod or a sage or a lowly person, you have to accept. And there are some things we have to accept. Like, you know, birth, death, disease, old age, you don't have a choice. Many things, they're just arrangements. You know, you get on a bus or get in a plane, and, you know, one time I I had a middle seat, and next to me were two very overweight people. What to do? Didn't have a choice. Like, you know, just like, okay. You know, they have these special, you know, they call them extension seat belts. And so they both had to have one. And, you know, anyway, some things you don't have a choice in the matter. You can say, I'll get off the plane. I'm not going to sit in the middle of these two people. But otherwise, you don't have, it's just circumstance. or, you know, a physical ailment, something. It's coming simply because of our past deeds, and it's just coming. Some of the things are the result of our choices. We choose such and such, and because we've chosen such and such, there's a fruit of that choice. The fruit may be sweet or bitter, or whatever. And that's something that we're responsible for. We can't, once some bad thing happened in a temple, and they were giving Prabhupada a report about the bad thing that happened, and they said, but it's Krishna's mercy. And Prabhupada blasted them and said, don't blame your foolishness on Krishna. You do the thing properly. It's not Krishna's mercy, it's your stupidity, your foolishness. So a little discrimination is needed to understand what's the outcome of our choices and what are things that are just destined. But those things that are just destined, one could say, Jed Bard could say to the king, this isn't my nature. This isn't my right position. I'm out of here. I'm going to make a choice and say, see you later, king. Find somebody else to carry your palanquin. He didn't. Not to say he didn't have any choice, but he chose that I'll just accept. I'll just read it again. When suffering reversed conditions, the devotees always considers the reversed conditions are the Lord's concessions. In the verse, out of his natural humility, he never considered himself a great devotee, and he agreed to suffer the results of his past karma. Like an ordinary man, he thought that by carrying the palanquin, he was destroying the reactions of his past misdeeds. Thinking in this way, he began to carry the palanquin as before. So it's important that for our practical devotional service that we understand the dynamic here. There may be circumstances in our lives similarly where, you know, you get it right that we're not this body, and therefore we're not the designations of the body. And then there's circumstances that, you know, you're moving down the path of life and here come circumstances. And you may simply accept them. You may not accept them and do something else, but in the case of Jed Bharat, in our case, we may simply accept them and carry on in that circumstance, accepting as Jed Bharat is thinking. There's some arrangement of service for Krishna, by Krishna for me, or there's some purification due to my past misdeeds, and I simply accept that it's something, there are some things we just can't do anything about, like, you know, it's Kali Yuga. If we're going to preach in the city, then there are certain conditions that come along with being in the city. That's not the same as being in the country. And if you're in the country, there's certain conditions that you accept. It's not the same as if you're in the city. So once you make a decision to do one or the other, you just accept, and there's some inconvenience, and that's fine. It's part of accepting my past misdeeds and working through them so that I can do this nice service of preaching Krishna consciousness in the city, and because there's lots of people here, lots of people that could use a little Krishna consciousness, including myself, and so I'm here. And I'm accepting the circumstances, carrying on. For example. And you can think of other examples. Live in the ashram, and that, you know, the guy next to me is snoring or something. Anyway, if we work in a cooperative way, we can address the inconveniences that are built into, you know, the decision to take part in Krishna consciousness and preach Krishna consciousness, etc. And you know, sometimes things go well, and sometimes things go the other way, and sometimes things are mixed. It's like, you know, it's predicted to rain today. So we need to make a decision about, are we going to go and Harinam in the rain, or are we going to go and Harinam and maybe it won't rain, or are we going to just stay inside and do the alternative of just have kirtan in the temple room? That's something we can't do anything. It's going to rain or it's not going to rain. It's like at 60%. That's what they're saying right now. So what are we going to do? So some decision has to be made, and then we accept the consequences of this one or that one, whatever it is. And I think we should make a decision sooner enough so we can send a message out to people. It's definitely going to be there, or it's definitely going to be here. Or we'll let you know by 1 o'clock if it's going to be here or there or something, so that people can make their plan. So we serve accordingly. Get the palanquin and carry the palanquin, because that's what the service requires at this time. Although my identity may not be a palanquin carrier, my identity is a servant of Krishna. I can do this service, or I can do that service. It's service. As long as I can do service, that's my happiness. Okay, so any discussion? Nityananda Pran.
Guru Maharaj, on this principle of punishing a mad person is not going to bring about an effect. We see that in many instances, to think of it, couple, Narada Muni punished Nalakuvera and Manigriva. Or there are instances where Indra is punished for his behaviors. So certainly there's some other principle also operating there. And may I request you to...
Can you turn the speaker?
May I request you to...
I was thinking that as during the class, certainly part of Vedic culture is the duty of a king is administer appropriate punishment. And the reason behind administering appropriate punishment, at least part of it, is to alleviate the karma that would accrue to the person if they're not properly punished, appropriately punished. That's like, you know, the benevolent picture of why punishments are given. And another sense is, you know, give protection to innocent people. If there's somebody that's going to violate innocent people who are law-abiding, then the law-breaking people need to be curbed. So the point that's being made here is the madness isn't going to change. So going back to these other examples, you can change behavior for some time. And I was even thinking as I was speaking about it, I was considering... to go into a little thing, I'll do it now, about Devamrita Swami's father is a police officer in the city of New York. He's a high-ranking police officer. And during a certain period of time, during the mayorship of Rudolph Giuliani, there was a proactive procedure, and they're doing something a little different now. It's also becoming effective. But persons were put in charge of precincts depending for a period of time if they could not catch criminals but reduce the incidences of crime. It was very proactive. That means they would go into neighborhoods where crime was crime-prone and find out like what the problems are that are causing the crime, like the frustrations in gangs and whatever it is, and address the problems in the home and the problems before there was a crime. And you had 6 months to proactively reduce the incidences of crime in your precinct. And they were actively moving the precincts, like, you know, from this place to that place where they saw it was accident prone or crime prone. And it reduced crime. It was hugely successful. It was computerized and, you know, they were using helicopters and, you know, monitoring. But it was more, it was proactive. It was effective. So it's part of the duty of government. Like, you know, in the case of Narada, it wasn't like a duty of Narada, but it directly confronted him. Now he had some, what's the appropriate response? His punishment was, you know, pretty powerful personality. He just, you know, cursed them to become trees, and they become trees. Pretty powerful. You're a criminal. I curse you to become a tree. And they're a tree. But, you know, the purpose behind it wasn't just letting them have it, slapping them in the face. It was relieving them of the tendency by first checking the tendency and then replacing the tendency with a higher tendency, devotion to Krishna. So it was benedictory. It's not to say that if you take it at face value, everybody, the statement is, everybody is ruled by madness. That's one. Second, disciplining people that are mad isn't going to change anything. So therefore, don't discipline anybody. That's not the right conclusion. The discipline needs to be done appropriately and effectively, where not just behavior, because when Giuliani was, you know, had his two terms, the next mayor was, you know, a goofball, and crime went back up again. It was really good for the economy. It was like, I remember that period. Roads got repaired. He was a good mayor. I mean, you know, from a material point of view. Like in Chicago, the roads are a wreck. There's the streets in the city. Anyway, it was like that in New York, and he fixed it. You know, and he did all kinds of things, like, you know, where they had offices that was, they were so impersonal. He just removed the cages and the walls and the glass and the, you know, stuff, and they would sit down with people, just like at a table, and have their discussions with them. And hired more staff. He just like, but then another. So correcting behaviors is part of the duty of a king, but it doesn't change, you know, the bodily conception and the nescience. So it's inadequate. It's something like Duryodhana being an effective administrator, but not being God conscious. So that's not, they were not the advocacy of, Jed Bard is not the advocate of, just be heavy with people and then you can correct all the problems. So that's not, that's the message. It doesn't mean no discipline. Never discipline persons in the bodily conception of life. That's not the message. Along with discipline must come spiritual knowledge. And sometimes spiritual knowledge alone is sufficient. Sometimes more than spiritual knowledge is necessary in order that spiritual knowledge can go in. Okay. Next, Acharya. Ashraya, you have something? You had your hand up.
So I guess I will. Accepting our situation. So something that I've perceived is that sometimes You said as long as a devotee has service, he's happy. So, but he'll just accept his situation. But sort of a mentality that I have experienced is that our idea of service is something outside of ourselves, especially because we're thinking in terms of like preaching or something, you know, external. So then it becomes, well, I don't accept my situation because I want to be able to do service in this external manifestation sort of way. It's, so it seems like that could be, you know, a situation where we, you know, try to overcome something for the genuine desire to do some service. But then it can also just become a, I'm not really accepting the situation that I'm getting. So is the line, you know, you try honestly, but you don't just do prayas to try to get over the situation. You just make an honest attempt without, you know, losing your Krishna consciousness? Or is it also acceptable to just accept the situation and, you know, whatever level of service I can do right now, and I'm not going to try to do any more than that in an external sense, I mean.
It sounds a little bit like your question yesterday about accepting yourself. It's not spot on, but it's like that. To keep it simple, because, you know, this kind of question can go in a number of different directions. According to my capacity, I may be able to do this much or do something over there that I'm really not so comfortable with, but I can do it. So it's in principle, it's good for us to stretch a bit. That's like my answer. And it's the duty of someone who's giving services, has that, you know, responsibility and authority to consider an individual's nature and the overall picture, and, you know, something that, the overall picture says something that needs to be done, and if we can do this something, very wonderful things will happen, it's a great opportunity. So consider the nature and the capacity and the stretch limits of that individual or the individuals that are in the pool. And sometimes we're just not going to try to do that. Preaching. Anyway, like the Krishna Lunch program, because there's somebody that stood up and said, "Jai, I want to do this," and you know, with endorsement and support and encouragement and blessings and not a whole lot of facility, started. So then we presented this to people and temples and centers in the Midwest. They may not be able to do it. And if they try to do it, it might be like an over-endeavor and a disappointment. So that's not a good idea. So managers have to see, and, you know, individuals and their capacities, and individuals need to see, you know, the bigger picture as much as I can, and, you know, then a little stretch is good. Good. You stretch a little bit, and then you can stretch one's ability, one's capacity moves. Don't stretch and doesn't. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. I had a question. I had an interesting discussion with Ashraya Prabhu one day about how in conventional language, even though our philosophy is that we're not the body, when we're speaking, we're often saying, "I'm doing this, I'm going here."
Sure.
Just the nature of our exchanges seems to reinforce a bodily conception.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if Prabhupada ever mentioned that, or is there anything to do about that, or we should just try to get over it?
Yeah. The third one.
Because it's not very practical, I guess, to speak on a more absolute position, like my body is...
You can do that. But conventional works too. Anyone else? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. You were mentioning, or in the purport earlier, you were reading that Jada Bharat was considering that his situation, because he was very exalted and he didn't consider himself a very pure devotee, he considered his situation was due to reactions of karma or experiencing past karmas.
Yeah.
But I had had a discussion with someone about karma, and I understood it as a mechanical system, sort of that Krishna wasn't directly involved in. It was sort of something that ran on its own. And that once one becomes a devotee, Krishna then takes a very personal interest in the lives of that devotee. So they experience the reactions caused by decisions that they've made in the past, but it's not exactly karma, or it's similar somehow, but there's also some difference based off of Krishna's interest. So what is that difference, or are the concepts different in understanding, or are they basically like the same thing, just with different interests?
I got the question. Here's a short answer. Prabhupada writes it in the purport. Let's see if I can find it. But he considers token reaction. Lord's concession. Here's the verse. When suffering reversed conditions, the devotee always considers that the reversed conditions are the Lord's concession. It doesn't say they consider it as their karma. They consider it as the Lord's concession. Here's Prabhupada's explanation of that. Supposing by karma someone is to get a broken arm, they become a devotee, and instead they get a scratch in their arm. It's a concession. It's a tap instead of a over that way. Please don't become complacent in your devotional life. Know that just back there, there's lots of bad karma. So here's just a little token reminder of what's back there. So be mindful that you're coming from a dark place and heading towards, you know, the receiving of Krishna's mercy. So part of his mercy is a token reminder. Prabhupada used that phrase I'm familiar with. Here it's concession. So now I'm a devotee, trying to be a devotee, and I'm going along the path of life, and here comes this difficult situation or problem or calamity or disease or something. It's not the same. It's, oh, that's just my karma. It's Krishna's concession. He's helping me to remember my dark past and not become, you know, be mindful of staying in the mode of being the recipient of his mercy, and let that play itself out however Krishna wants to help me be mindful of, you know, don't be complacent. So it's the internal potency. Directly. Krishna is arranging directly. as opposed to karma, which is through the agency of the material nature. And it's, you know, the term mechanical is a little, it's I get the idea, but it's a little not okay. Because behind the machine, there's an operator. So it works like a machine, in that sense, mechanical. But behind the machine is the operator. Okay? Okay, thank you very much, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jaya.